In a career that spans four decades, Melissa Manchester has shown tremendous versatility. Singer, songwriter, musical collaborator, teacher, and actor, she's a Grammy Award winner with 20 albums to her credit, and she's just released her first CD of original material in a decade. It's called You Gotta Love the Life, and in it, she collaborates with musicians who have inspired her over the years. Tonight, Melissa Manchester opens a four-night stand at 54 Below on West 54th Street, and all of that brings her to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
It's been a decade since you put out an album of original work. What have you been doing besides recording? Have you been writing a lot of songs?
Well, I've been writing, but I've been teaching at USC, the Thornton School of Music, and I've been finding my way. It's not that I didn't have the material for the album. I just couldn't figure out how to move it forward. And my students at USC actually led me to this moment because they live in this industrial revolution that has taken place in my industry. I just couldn't, and my mindset was under an old paradigm that you signed with a company and, you know, they own your work even after you've made their money
back.
Well,
that's the way the record business used to work.
That's correct, and that no longer worked for me. And it was my students who kept showing up with projects. And I said, how did you get it done? Thinking that they would tell me about an independent label they'd signed with. And they said, we did it through crowdfunding. You should do that. And I said, great. What is that? And it turned out that one of my former students became my project manager. And, you know, and the rest was history.
So the students are teaching the teacher.
Yes, sir.
But how did you wind up at teaching on a university level? Did somebody call you?
I know, even I asked that question. Yes, the vice dean of their newest division, the baby school, which is the pop division, because Thornton, as you probably know, is known for its classical and jazz geniuses that go out into the world. And their pop division is only 6 years old. And Chris Sampson reached out to me to teach a master class. And I, after it was done, I said, thank you very much. Have a nice day. And they kept calling me back. So I've been there 4 years now, and it's remarkable.
I'm assuming that you're surprised by how good some of them are, but what about the ones who you think this kid will never make it? Do you try to dissuade them?
One must be kind. But at that level, everybody's pretty darn good and very committed and much, much more educated than what I was like at that age. And that's part of being a part of the new world, too.
I'm thinking about the title of your new album, You Gotta Love the Life. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're passing along the wisdom from some hard-learned lessons.
Yes,
sir. What kinds of sacrifices have you had to make?
Well, this came out of a discussion I was having with my daughter. She was contemplating whether she was going to follow in my footsteps of that artistic path. And honestly, I didn't have a choice. It glommed onto me and never left. And so what this version of normal is comfortable for me, and that means the unsteady, unsafe, unsecure, unsane version of life where your work keeps reflecting your journey. Now, if that sounds like a good idea to you, you sign up. But if there's a suggestion, there's anything else you want to do, you should.
Well, some songwriters are very autobiographical, and mm-hmm. others just work within the form.
Mm-hmm.
But you've been relatively autobiographical, haven't
I you? Have, and yet I consider myself part of what I call the bridge generation. We were raised listening to magnificent singers who had magnificent writers write for them, write for that voice. And yes, when I was 16, 17, and the first, second wave of the singer-songwriter had moved from the folk genre to mainstream, and the radio was exploding with writers and performers who were reshaping the American songbook. They were infusing the lyrics with more psychology, more poetry. Joni Mitchell, Laura Nyro, who was my muse, Sly and the Family Stone, the Beatles, even. So it was very exciting.
You've worked with Joe Sample, the founding member of the Jazz Crusaders. Mm-hmm. He's on this record. Mm-hmm. One of the last things he did before he died.
Yes, indeed, yes.
But do you think of yourself as being part of the jazz tradition in some ways?
You know, it's
I mean, Joni Mitchell has often flirted with
yes,
jazz.
Yes. The thing is, I wanted this album to reflect the variety of musics that appeal to me. And that was always a stumbling point for record companies whose job it is to categorize you so it makes it easier for them to sell you. And from my experience, my vast experience on the stage where I do a huge variety of styles of music, you know, nobody ever needed to be carted away in an ambulance from the trauma. And so I wanted that music to finally be represented on an album.
But we do understand why the record companies felt that way, because in the old days, radio determined whether a record would be a success or not, and they just wanted to get into the right slot.
Yep.
Were you pressured to start to think top 40 at times?
Oh, yes. And the thing is, that was one of my stumbling points with the mindset of the record companies. They were always interested in what was current, and I was always interested in what was timeless. Hmm. And so it doesn't quite line up.
When I was in the record business, I asked somebody who ran one of the companies, who are your favorite singers? And he listed all of the people who were in the top 10 at that moment. I said, no, not who you would like to have signed to your label.
Yes.
Who do you listen to when you go home?
That's right.
And he looked at me like I was crazy.
Yeah, that's correct. Welcome to my world.
Well, in this, you have an impressive list of guests on this album.
Yes.
Dave Koz, Stevie Wonder, Dionne Warwick, Al Jarreau.
Yes.
Did you just call him up and say, hey, let's do something together?
Well, I have a personal connection with all of them, but the album was not created as a duets album, and the songs were not constructed as duets. But as I was recording them, the notion of, you know who would be great on this, started to show up.
You never thought, I'm going to write a song that I can do with Stevie Wonder.
Absolutely not. And because the song Other End of the Phone, I set Hal David's last lyric to music. It made sense to me that I would ask Dionne Warwick to show up on that, since she built her career on his lyrics.
And she didn't walk on by.
Indeed, she did. And Terry Wallman, who's my wonderful co-producer, had worked with Joe Sample. And I'd been trying to work with Joe for 30 years, but he was busy. And finally, I was able to fly to Houston and have him put his magnificent piano on it.
I'm speaking with Melissa Manchester, who has a new album out, You Gotta Love the Life, but also will be opening a four-night stand at 54 Below on West 54th Street.
It's actually three nights. It's actually tonight, tomorrow, and two shows on Saturday, which makes it seem like
a four-show stand.
That's exactly right.
Do you like working in a club like that?
I do. I get a chance to see people's teeth, see that they're smiling, see that they're present. I don't change my show at all. It's the show that I do, but
I've always wondered about that. When you're on the stage, you have less of a sense of whether people are paying attention or not. You assume they are, I'm sure. But when you're in a club and you're right there on the same level as the audience and looking at people sitting at tables, it is quite different. Do you feel any kind of interaction with them?
I always feel interaction. It doesn't matter if I'm playing Carnegie Hall or 54 Below. I always feel the communal response of the audience that they're not aware of, but I feel their presence and I feel their energy, and you work off of that. That's the joy.
You spoke recently at a TEDx conference in California, and the topic of your talk was sonic thermals.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What exactly is sonic thermal?
Sonic thermal, I know. When I told my sister that title, she went, wow, what?
You should be teaching a science course now.
Yeah. The sonic thermal is it's the energy of a song and the singer, and what happened to me that I started to recognize in terms of tonality when I was tiny, tiny, tiny. It started when my father would be practicing bassoon for the Met Opera, and he would take a break, and then he knew that I loved the melody to Greensleeves, and it would make me start to spin. And when my mother would vacuum, it would put me to sleep. So all of that started to be the leading foot into the door, so to speak. And when I was studying in school, I would hear the tonality of the teachers instead of what they were saying. And in terms of music, the sonic thermal is what lifts me and transports me emotionally. And when an idea gloms onto me and won't let me go and it insinuates itself where I know it has an urgency to be expressed, I know that that something is locked into me where an invisible dot has shown up and I need to keep investigating it so I can find the next invisible dot.
So how does that work when you write the lyric first, I assume, and then the sonic thermal just tells you where that melody is going to go?
When I'm collaborating, I write whatever shows up in the room. Usually it's the music. When I'm writing by myself, because if you have an idea, you have to figure out if you're hearing the title of a song or something that's tucked away in the second verse. But if that's true, who would say that and who uses that language? It's wonderful.
You grew up in a classical music home.
I did.
Did you ever consider classical music?
Never once.
Because you grew up with rock and roll as well?
No. Well, yes, we had very eclectic musical tastes in my family. I heard my father playing bassoon all the time. So we listened to the opera on QXR every Saturday. But we listened to all kinds of music, jazz, and we listened to a lot of Broadway musical because pop music was coming from the musical theater stages. And I was interested in trying to learn how to play the bassoon when I was 10, and my father kept assuring me, "You're too young." And
it's
I said, No.
It's a difficult instrument to play.
Yes, right. And so he said, "Okay, all right." So he sat me, on the strap that holds the instrument, and I started to blow into the bassoon and fainted, which was a sign that God didn't want me to learn how to play the bassoon.
It is, but it's a double reed instrument,
it is,
isn't
yes.
it?
That
has to be the hardest one to get a sound out of. I once
yes.
tried to get a sound out of, I think, an Indian Chennai, and all that happened was...
How'd that work for you?
A lot of saliva dripped down the reeds.
And I will be thinking of that and your face for the rest of the day. Thank you.
No, but it's...
It's hard.
It's not like even putting a saxophone mouthpiece
That's
in your
right.
mouth.
It's very hard. And to get a beautiful sound, as my dad did, was really something.
So that determined the fact that you weren't going to play an instrument other than a guitar?
Yeah. I mean, I was always a singer, and we all sang in my house. After dinner when company showed up, my mother with her beautiful... soprano voice, and my sister and I always picked out the odd harmonies. That was my position.
Has your approach to songwriting changed over the four decades you've been in the business?
Well, yes. I mean, you start to understand, you start to sculpt language. Language is this brick of marble that you sculpt away at to convey your idea. And the thing about songs is my assumption is that a listener will hear it once and move on. And so you have to tidy it up so it really represents your inner world, and then you got it.
Did you read this recent study that reveals that songs that repeat a lot tend to become hits?
No, I hadn't read that. I thought you were going to say the report where if children listen to Mozart more, it makes them smarter.
That we're not sure that's true, but the other thing definitely is true.
Well, it's interesting because for my students, for instance, their aesthetic is a rhythm-driven song as opposed to the aesthetic of our time, which was a melody-driven song. And yes, things that are repeated may be easier to memorize, but in terms of composing a song, it's harder to develop an idea. That's why I always assign them songs from the first volume of the American Songbook.
Now, you studied with Paul Simon when you were young
at
NYU.
Mm-hmm.
Was he a model for you in teaching?
He was indeed, absolutely. And he was the one that prophesied that songs, American songs, would be rhythm-driven as opposed to melody-driven. Yes, absolutely. And I teach essentially what he taught me, which is that all of the stories have been told. It's the way you tell your story.
And then you became associated with Bette Midler.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been a good time to start performing here in
New York.
It was
amazing. I stumbled over
the most... Were you a harlot?
I was the founding member of the Harlots with Barry Manilow, and I was the toots in the middle. And it was an incredible time to be in the city. I mean, I stumbled over adventures, and it was amazing.
And now I hear you're donating some of the proceeds from the CD to the Manilow Music Project.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, his fans bring in used instruments, and his people repair them and donate them to public schools.
And so you want other kids to learn. Music education has really been cut back in schools all over the country.
It's ridiculous. It's folly. It's folly. Music education is good for learning, and it's good for shaping the mind. It's good for critical thinking. You know, the studies are, you know, enough to fill this room.
Ed from Brooklyn has written, and he wants to know about your experiences being a female musician in a man's world in the 70s. And you have to tell me it quickly.
Yeah, it was rough. But, you know, I forged on, and every time somebody said no to me, I heard myself say yes. That's all.
And that was it? But did they say, well, you're a girl?
Yeah, they were, you know, they had quotas, and sometimes they said, you're a girl, sometimes they said, you're a white girl. You know, it was just ridiculous, and I found my way.
Melissa Manchester will be performing at 54 Below from tonight through the 29th.
And 28th.
Getting misinformation. There's a link for tickets on our show page at WNYC.org. By the way, your former percussionist, Dean Prudy, called in to say hello.
Ah, lovely. Hello, Ben.
You never know who's listening.
That's right, yeah.
And maybe we should just listen to a little more from the album, can we? Melissa Manchester, the new album is called You Gotta Love the Life. Thank you so much for being on our show.
My pleasure. Thank you.